Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
And welcome back. I am Carrie Weber, executive editor at America Magazine, and I am here with Father Matt Malone and Father Jim Martin, and we have been discussing Pope Francis's tendency to be among the people, and that has also made us think about another article on AmericaMagazine.org. It's called Meet the Jesuit Priest Serving Catholics and Muslim in War-Torn Syria. And Father Jim, you did an interview with Father Ziad Hilal, who's a Jesuit and a project consultant for Syria of the Aid to the Church in Need. And he's been stationed in Aleppo since 2016. And this is really, truly an example of somebody who is really on the ground, living out the Christian life in a really, really radical way. And he talks about, you know, the situation for the people in Aleppo at the moment and what he's doing and what people are feeling. And there's just some really, really heartbreaking moments in it.
Yeah, you know, we reached out to him and I asked him five or six simple questions. And I thought I think the readers would most want to know, describing the situation, certainly, but also talking about his own faith, where he finds God. And my final question was, are you afraid? And if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind reading one of his responses, because I think it's more articulate than what I could say. So the last question was, are you afraid? And Father Hilal writes, despite the harsh conditions and the violence and pain we endure during the war, we continue our mission, a dangerous mission. Of course, one gets scared, considering all the deaths and violence that are directly affecting this life. But our solid belief helps us defeat this fear, knowing that God is with us no matter what. Our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ teaches us, peace I leave you, my peace I give you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid. And Father Hilal writes, hope is always stronger than fear. And you know, Carrie, I mean, we say those things and I believe those things. But hearing about that and hearing Father Hilal, someone writing from Aleppo, writing that gives those words such power and weight and gravity. And I hope people read the interview. It's up on America Magazine. And, you know, as you say, this is someone who's really walking the walk. And we talk about, he talks about Father Vanderloot, who was a Dutch Jesuit who was martyred there. And we think about the martyrs as sort of far off, and we wonder how that can happen. And here's an example of a man who is, you know, thank God, alive and living and well, but who's chosen to stay with the people, who's chosen to stay with the poor, even in a dangerous situation. And so these people, I think we must support from our pocketbooks and wallets, but also with our prayers and our good wishes.
Yeah, I was really struck by the little moments that he mentions in terms of just the things that people continue to do in the midst of such violence. You know, the remaining believers, he said, you know, they're still going to church. Kids are still going to religious education classes. People are going to mass. People are getting baptized. People are getting married. These things that you think of as sort of a joyous occasion in the midst of a joyous place, in a sense. I feel like on those days that you feel like that joy sort of extends. But in this case, it's in the midst of such chaos, but yet there is still that joy.
Yeah, and I mean, I worked with refugees for 2 years, and one of the things that was the most, I think, shocking to me and moving is that these are people just like us. I mean, they get baptized, they want to get married, they have a job, they have hopes. And we look, I think, sometimes at refugees and also sort of people in war-torn countries, and we see them in their rags and, you know, kind of dirty faces, and we forget that these are doctors and lawyers and teachers and that who have lives. And, yeah, you know, imagine what your life would be like if it were sort of taken away like that. And I think that kind of when we read stories like this and when we hear stories from refugees and people who are in countries that are sort of under violence, to hear their stories, I think, reminds us how we're all brothers and sisters, and I think can really open our hearts to them. And I want to be clear. I mean, you know, we can help these people sort of financially through, you know, JRS and Catholic Relief Services and places like that. So in addition to our prayers for people like Father Hilal, we can really help in a material way.
Yeah, JRS, for those unfamiliar, is the Jesuit Refugee Services, which Father told us provides 10,000 hot meals every day in addition to medical and social services for all the people in Aleppo, regardless of their faith.
Yeah, it's great work. And as you say, Carrie, I think there's a very popular misconception that the Catholic Church either only helps Catholics or helps people only if they're going to convert, which is ridiculous. So, yeah, it's a very worthwhile venture.
Yeah, and that's true. I also came back last week from Gaza, and Catholic Relief Services is the second largest humanitarian provider in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And there are about six Catholics in Gaza.
Yeah, exactly. They're not checking their baptismal certificates. You know, the joke, right. When I was in East Africa, you know, someone said, I was working with Jesuit Refugee Service, and people saying, we only deal with Catholics. And I said, I wouldn't have the foggiest idea who's a Catholic among, right. You know, all these refugees from Uganda and Somalia, and who knows? And, you know, this is not, I mean, Jesus doesn't ask for people's ID cards before he heals them, or
right.
I mean, he talks to the Roman centurion, he talks to the Syrophoenician woman. I mean, he's dealing with people who aren't Jewish, and so yeah, the Catholic Church has always dealt with people and treated people beyond just the sort of baptismal roles.
On March 17th, I was at the annual dinner hosted by the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick of New York, and I sat with the Dutch Consul General. Who was at the dinner, and he knew Father Vanderloo, and was a friend of his, and he told me that the man was a saint, and no one even told him that he should leave because everyone knew that he wouldn't. He said he was in love with those people. He was in love with the people he served, and he was not going to abandon them.
Well, and that's martyrdom. I mean, this is what happens. I mean, we see it in the case of all sorts of people. We think about the Jesuits in El Salvador, the women in El Salvador, and they're not courting death. I mean, they're not going down there to die. They're not. I mean, I think maybe in the past there was a kind of glorification of martyrdom in that sense, but more often than not, and you know, you think of the Trappists, in Algeria, the subject of the movie of Gods and Men, they stay with the people who are being persecuted. You know,
right.
Because they love them, and because they're serving them, and because it's inconceivable for them to leave, you know, their community, their brothers and sisters, and then martyrdom comes in that way. And it's incredibly inspiring, and to know that there are, you know, for me as a Jesuit, that there are Jesuits like this doing this kind of work. When you know, and I say this about myself, when we're living very comfortably, in New York City, is very inspiring, and it also asks us to kind of try to live as heroically as we can.
Right. And I think it was Father Kolbenbach, who the late Father General of the Society of Jesus, who would remind us that there have been more Jesuit martyrs since the 1960s than there were
yep.
in the first 300 years of the Society.
And, you know, there's a great, in the General Congregation 32, where the Jesuits decided that the mission of the Society of Jesus was the service of faith, of which the promotion of justice is an absolute requirement. Father Arupe, who was Father Kolbenbach's predecessor, said, "Are we ready to pay this price?"
Right.
Because he knew that once we really stepped up and kind of increased our identification with people who are facing injustices, that the Society and Jesuits, you know, like a lot of lay people, would pay. And we have. It's very inspiring.
Right. And that's actually not a bad segue to Father Gilger, because it seems to me that who's going to explain to us, first of all, for our listeners who don't know what the Benedict Option is, and then talk a bit about his essay about it. But it seems to me that the option itself is a luxury. And, you know, the people of Syria and the people of Haiti and the church there doesn't have that option. And that's a really important thing to keep in mind, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, we welcome Father Paddy Gilger, Culture Editor of America, to the broadcast.
Pleasure to be here with you guys.
Yeah, great to have you with us. So for our listeners who don't know, what is this Benedict Option and why is everybody talking about it?
Yeah, great great question. The Benedict Option is kind of been popularized, not originated maybe, but popularized by a commentator who writes for the American Conservative named Rod Dreher. Rod Dreher is a former Catholic, now an Orthodox practitioner of Orthodoxy, Orthodox Christianity, and has written a book recently just called The Benedict Option. And in there, what he calls for in The Benedict Option is kind of a strategic withdrawal from certain aspects of contemporary culture and life in American society in recognition, in his opinion and analyses of kind of the fallen state of American Christianity and American political culture. And so his solution to this is a monastic one in his interpretation of monasticism, a particular interpretation, which is to withdraw into small communities of faith and practice so as to form ourselves better in fidelity to Christian teaching, Christian magisterium, that kind of thing. So that's the basics there. I'm sure that he would have some complaints with that. I might have some complaints with that definition, but it's a start.
Right. And the piece is called What Rod Dreher Gets Right in the Benedict Option is Just as Important as What He Gets Wrong. And, of course, you can find it at americamagazine.org. So what does he get right and wrong?
Yeah. I think a lot of the reason I wrote the piece the way I did, maybe to say this way, is that I think a lot of people are going to interpret this book sometimes rightly, but they're going to interpret it from the perspectives that we already hold. Like people who are going to call themselves liberals are going to interpret it from the left, and they're going to say, well, there are these six really important mistakes that he's making, and so I'm just going to ignore the rest of it. And then people from the right are going to interpret it, I think, in some very frustrating ways also. Maybe that's surprisingly, given that he writes for the American Conservative, but Dreher's pretty explicit. He thinks that the kind of 1980s project of the religious majority, silent majority, being able to influence the Republican Party and preserve the quote-unquote Christian character of the country, he thinks that's over. And he thinks that that's lost, and that people who actually want to practice Christianity and have that be the center of their life and communities need to withdraw even from that kind of political participation and form themselves within there. So what I'm really trying to say is that both of these things have these dissatisfactions, that dissatisfaction from the left, dissatisfaction from the right. Those are legitimate in some real ways. But if we just stop there with the dissatisfactions that people are, I think, expectantly going to have with the book, we're doing ourselves a disservice, because he's naming something that's deeply important about our culture right now, and he's giving us at least some tools for our response to, like, talk seriously, in my terms, about disciplines and practices of Christian communities. Basically, how we form Christian persons. How do we become Christians in practice as well as just, like, in mental ascent? And that's a really, really important conversation.
I think one of the challenges he talks about is that we can't really agree on sort of what that looks like. And do you have any thoughts on that? Do you have a place where we might agree?
Well, okay, that cuts, like, I think right to the end of what I would want to say about all these things. But yeah, I want to put that on the table, like, right here at the front. So where I'm very sympathetic to Dreher is that is his insistence that to be a Christian, you have to be a Christian habit, not just in mental ascent. So this is like what we're talking about here. Like, how do we treat the homeless? How do we, you know, try to put our money where our mouth is, or our bodies where our mouths are, with regard to our attention and our care for people in Aleppo or in, you know, North Africa? So how do we become Christians in habit and in practice, not just in mind? And so that emphasis is, I think, really the best part of what he's getting at there. And I think the thing that he recognizes that I'm not sure we're willing to recognize all the time is that for that to happen, for us to do that, it takes communities that teach us how to do it. Now, what those communities look like ought to be up for real debate. Like, we ought to really be able to have serious discussions about what those look like. And I'm not sure that he does a great job, you know, cashing out the diversity of those kinds of communities that can empower people to make those kinds of sacrifices. But the fact that our own lives, like the fact that we're sitting around this table, that we've made commitments in our own lives to be able to offer ourselves as best we can, and in particular ways, married and as celibate clergy, to the world and to God in the world, that came out of communities. That came out of sets of practices that we were formed into. And in fact, as we continue to form ourselves, we've taken on more of them.
Right.
So we can't resist that. Like, we really can't resist that just because we're happy about, you know, our own individual freedoms.
I agree with you, too. I thought that the strength of the book was this emphasis on praxis. And this is something that a number of young contemporary theologians are talking a lot about right now.
Well said.
I know you and I have talked about Bill Kavanaugh at DePaul,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Who has said, you know, he's a political theologian, and so he wrestles with the question is, you know, are we a Christian country? Is Catholicism compatible with America and so forth? And he says, but, you know, at that level of abstraction, you know, who cares in a sense, right? Like, if you call yourself a Christian, but you don't bother to go to church on Sunday and you spend the rest of the week in the relentless pursuit of profits in the bond market, then
yes.
Who are you really worshiping?
That's right. Who cares? I mean, so, you know, not to get overly abstract here, which I'm sure I already am overly abstract, I apologize. But look, like, this is what the famous French-Canadian Roman Catholic philosopher Charles Taylor calls the problem of excarnation.
Right.
That whereas God, the God we believe in, is the one who incarnates himself relentlessly, God's self relentlessly in the human experience. This tendency in Christianity over the last, you know, 400 years, 500 years, has been to excarnate ourselves into, you know, intellectual patterns of ascent. And so to the extent that Dreyer combats that, I'm really on board with this kind of thing, and combats it not just individualistically, but in communities.
But how is he combating? The thing I don't understand is, I mean, so much of it is about withdrawal. And if you're going to talk about praxis, and I would say, I don't know any serious Christian or theologian, you know, who says, you know, we shouldn't practice our faith, basically. We should just, it's all about, I mean, maybe some evangelicals might say it's only about, you know, saying that Jesus saves you, and I've accepted Jesus Christ as my personal savior, and that's it. But I would say most serious Christians and thoughtful Christians would say that needs to be put into practice. My struggle with it is, you know, you're talking about kind of Aleppo and sort of the homeless, but at least from, I have not read the book, but at least the conversations I've heard about the Benedict option is that it's mostly withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that bothers me is withdrawal into this kind of monastic, this sort of what I would say is a kind of parody of monasticism, which I don't know any monks that are totally withdrawn from the world. You know, they participate, the monastic community kind of participates in the life of the community. And so I'm struggling with the collision between praxis, which means the church. I mean, after all, the Second Vatican Council talked about the church in the modern world, not opposed to, not above, not withdrawn, and this withdrawal. So could you speak to that a little bit, the difference between, or the sort of tension between withdrawal and exercising your faith in the world?
Yeah. I think, actually, just the way you put it here, I think that Dreyer would be very on board with this. In fact, he's said explicitly over and over again that the point of withdrawal is for engagement. So the point of withdrawal, of building communities, is to be able to be a light to the world. And he says that again and again and again. Now, that's not to say that there aren't real issues with your criticism. I think there are in some ways, because I disagree myself with some of his evaluation of the world from which we're withdrawing.
Right, right.
Now, that's a real key conversation to have. But I think there are deep and there are shallow ways to interpret what the Benedict option is. And I think there are real people who are articulating shallow versions of the Benedict option. I wouldn't want to put that on Dreyer himself. And I don't think that's entirely fair for us to do so. But I'm 100% with you.
When I was reading it, I thought to myself, he should call this the Wellington option, because this was the strategy of the Duke of Wellington. Strategic retreat.
Right.
Well, one of the strategic retreat, but the goal is still to win the battle.
Yeah.
Because of some of the things that I've read about it, and also what you say, Patty, you talk about the book being suspicious of the, as you say, the quote, notorious LGBT agenda. The question is, who is allowed to be in those communities? Who is invited? Who is welcome? And who decides who is in those communities? And, you know, I think there's a kind of antipathy against the LGBT person, but also there's a kind of idea that the monastic life is totally homogenized, and to really up the ante, there are a lot of gay men and gay women in monasteries. And so if he's looking at that as a kind of paradigm for the way that the church is supposed to be, who gets in and who doesn't get in, and who decides who gets in?
Great questions. I think there are like six questions in there that I want
to
hit
on. Right. Take the easiest ones.
No, you got to take the toughest ones. Like, this is the reason to read this book well, is because it asks us the tougher questions. So I would say a couple things. First, let's say something about discipline and authority. And so, you know, Rod Dreyer himself is a former Catholic, is no longer Catholic, now part of the Orthodox community. And each of these different communities that he's describing have different models of leadership. And so we have a pretty clear answer to that. Like, who gets to decide that is, you know, our collectively discerned magisterium led by the bishops and by the Pope, like those kinds of things. And we rely on that to be able to make decisions. Now, the gift that we have, which is going to be difficult for Dreyer, and I'm sure he would just disagree with this really stridently, but that the gift that we have in the Catholic Church is that we really believe that this is ongoing, that doctrine for us is continuing to develop, not revelation, but doctrine is continuing to develop. We continue to unfold the kernels of revelation that we have been given over the long history of the church into the beautiful flowering tree of our tradition, our collective tradition. So that's, you know, this is my, you know, poor summary of Newman's entire life, John Hunter Newman's entire life in theology, which we are so grateful for and which gave birth to the Vatican II church that you're describing. So to the extent that that kind of model of the possibility that God continues to speak in the world and draw us on challenges ways that we have had that drawn on in the past, slavery, usury, all those different kinds of things, we have to continue to be able to be attentive to that.
The same Holy Spirit that guided our forebears guides us still.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, and the other question is, I'm glad you brought that up. How much of this, and I'm sure he doesn't mean to do this, how much of this is a rejection of the Second Vatican Council vision of the church turning towards the world versus the church kind of contra mundum? And that's the other thing that sort of makes me a little uncomfortable, that it seems to me to be a, I don't want to say anti-Vatican II, but a kind of pre-Vatican II mentality of our ecclesiology.
I think you're very right. And Dreyer himself sees that. In fact, the opening analogy and one of the closing analogies he uses in the book is of the traditional vision of the church as ark. Now, we explicitly moved away from that in Vatican II, and we did so for, I think, excellent reasons. Now, this is one of those things where I think we want to be careful about saying, what's the best version of what Dreyer is pointing us towards, and how can we really learn from it, and what is Dreyer himself saying? I think, for example, that Dreyer, as are all of us in our own processes of thinking and being converted to the Lord, he is himself continuing this journey. So at the beginning, he's very clear. The America is under floodwaters. We have to build an ark. Now, at the end of the book, he continues to use the ark analogy, but he adds another analogy to it of light. Now, that's interesting to me because I think there's an opening in him that he's seeing, okay, this is not just sufficient. But to be honest, look, he's no longer Catholic, and so these things are not exactly where his aim is. Now, he's trying to do very interesting, like, cross-denomination relationship building, but that's not his focus and not his dialogue partner at the moment. So there are some interesting issues there. One of the things that I really want to emphasize that I think leads right from what you're asking, Jim, is that our church is gifted with a great and beautiful internal plurality of spiritualities. And to the extent that any version, even the best versions, of the Benedict Option's withdrawal from an admittedly sometimes threatening world into small communities of practice, anytime those small communities of practice become overly normative so that only this community is the acceptable one, we've just simply become no longer Catholic.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that struck me with the book is that there runs through it a kind of view of original sin and of space that comes to us really from the reformers. That is a fundamental part of American culture, right? And Bill Kavanaugh, who I mentioned earlier, has pointed this out, right? Within American political culture, we tend to have this reading of the two cities, the city of God, city of man, that come to us from Augustine. In which we conceive of these cities as spaces, right? So when you disagree with one another or you can't share the same space, right? And of course he does a lot of work pointing out that Augustine doesn't really ever conceive of these as spaces, that they transcend space and time, and that which is why the Scarlet Letter is set in Massachusetts and not in Milan, right?
That's right. It makes no sense there.
Right, exactly. It's incoherent, right? And so what I wonder then is how countercultural is this in that sense? You know, that the movement away and the creation of another space, right, is actually a very American thing to do.
Yes.
Right? So it's not countercultural. Certainly not counter to the fundamental political culture of the country.
I think that's a great point. I really do. So one of the things that I think this drives home to us is that any of these communities of practice, whether it's Dreyer's or it's another version or whatever we want to talk about, these are all forming persons with the capacities to look at the world in particular kinds of ways. Now, the question that we ought to have is St. Paul's question. Are these communities teaching us to look upon the world with the eyes and the mind of Christ? Like, are we doing that? And what are we going to see in the world when we look with Christ's eyes? That is not the same thing that Dreyer is depicting all the time. And I think this is a real issue that we got to raise, and we got to be able to say, yes, we do need disciplined communities of practice that are going to constrain our tendencies towards, like, you know, rampant individualism and consumerism and et cetera. But those communities need to be able to produce in us the capacity to look upon the world and say the same thing that Jesus says to his disciples, the harvest is ripe. You know, it's right there.
So what does that look like in practical terms, both in terms of what Dreyer talks about and maybe more in terms of that recognition of the plurality that you're talking about?
Yeah, great question. So what Dreyer is talking about, sometimes it's some really, for me, surprising remedies. Like, this is my first deep exposure to Dreyer. I haven't been following him a ton, but I think it's really interesting in a lot of ways. One of the things he advocates is, for example, withdrawal from public schools. And so he's saying either we need to build new classical Christian education communities, so we educate people along the tradition of the Christian classics or the Western classics, or we need to homeschool. Now, that's really striking, you know, like these are really striking things that are going to be sympathetic in some serious ways, you know. But I think, so returning then to your other question, what do some of these other communities look like? I end the piece very intentionally by opposing, you know, Dreyer's call for order in a chaotic world by use of the Benedict option with another call for order in a chaotic world that looks very different than the Benedict option. And it's from Peter Morin, the co-founder of the Catholic Worker. And I'm trying to set these two in their similarity and their differences face to face with one another.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Peter Morin, because one of the questions I have is, as you're describing homeschooling and charter schools and withdrawing and communities, where are the poor in that community? I mean, can the poor decide that they are going to exercise the Benedict option? Where are they in the church?
Yeah, I think I don't have any great answer for that, and I don't think that Dreyer has any great answer for that. I hope that he would say, I don't know, help me figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't know what he would say.
Because I think that Peter Morin, which is equally radical,
yes,
is in a sense, you know, just as much a solution. You know, I mean, and ironically, you know, Dorothy Day says, you know, we've all felt the long loneliness, and the solution is community, you know,
yes,
which is in a sense what he's talking about.
That's right.
But it's a very different kind of community. I mean, the Catholic Worker door is open to all,
mm-hmm,
right? And it is a very much a going out, where this seems sort of a kind of a withdrawal. And interestingly, when Carrie was talking about Jesus, I was thinking, you know, Jesus says, go out into the world. He doesn't say to the disciples, very interestingly, all right, now set up little small communities on a hillside, which is quite interesting.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. You have about 2 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. No, he does it. He explicitly doesn't say those exact kind of things. I would say this: to the extent that these communities that we're forming, the Catholic Worker or the Benedict Option or otherwise, to the extent these are communities that are forming persons to re-engage in the world, this is a common ground that we really have, and that we have to learn from Dreyer and others how to build these kinds of communities that restrain the kind of individualism that we are always susceptible to in our society today. Like, everything that we do, all the technologies that we're immersed in, all these kinds of things individuate us constantly. They push us apart or into fragile, shallow commitments, and we have to leverage against that. So how we do that, I don't know. So to the Catholic Worker point you're making, the last thing I'll say is this, that yes, the door is open for all, as it should be open for all. Yes, it's oriented to the poor, as it should be oriented to the poor. Also, the Catholic workers themselves, those who live in those communities, live in deep, disciplined communities of practice for caring for exactly those people.
Right.
A very strong difference, a very strong commonality. It's weird to me, but they know, we keep trying to learn.
That's exactly right. And I actually, I think Father Jim had a really interesting point. I mean, and we didn't even get to the scapegoating of the sexual revolution that happens in the thesis, because I just kept thinking to myself, this is what has to drive us back into underground, right? Mm-hmm. This is you know, not the two world wars or you know, all the last 2,000 years of history, but this is the thing that's going to bring us down. And interesting stuff. Father Paddy Gilger, culture editor for America, thanks so much for being with us.
Great pleasure. Thanks, guys.
And you can check out the piece what Rod Dreher gets right in the Benedict Option is just as important as what he gets wrong, and it is at americamagazine.org, where you can also read all of the articles that we've talked about today, and you can follow our coverage of Pope Francis and of the Church in the United States, and our reporting from our team of correspondents throughout the world. Father Jim, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Yeah. It's always fun to have Jim here, isn't it?
Thank you. That's really nice.
I would agree with that.
Let me say, it's always fun to work for you, Matt. And with you, too.
Right. Well, we say that, you know, an editor at large should be at large. Right? And get out of the office. Right. Exactly. So you've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. To follow all of these stories, check us out at americamagazine.org, where you can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. And to subscribe to America, you can call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture for less than a buck a week. For Carrie Weber, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.